Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about prescribed burns to start the show today, and we have a couple of guests for you. Michelle Witeka, one of them. She is the prescribed fire specialist for the Wisconsin DNR. Michelle, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
With us as well, a guy who's been with us a lot of times over the years for a lot of different topics, Jeb Barzin. He is also, among all the other things that he does, he's chair of the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council. And Jeb, good to see your smiling face.
Well, it is wonderful to be here, and thank you.
So, as we talk with our two experts, I hope you'll join in. Have you seen a prescribed burn? Wondered how it's kept confined and under control? What do you know about the benefits of them? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And, of course, there's a big difference between a wildfire and a prescribed burn, Michelle. How do prescribed burns help our state's ecosystem?
Sure, absolutely. There's a huge difference, and I guess I'll start with that. So when you think of a wildfire, you think of especially the wildfires that we had up in Canada in the last summer that impacted our air quality. So wildfires like that, when they move through a forest, they don't just burn what's on the ground. They move through the crowns of the trees. They are so hot that they burn the organic matter of the soil and scorch it. Every single lick of vegetation from bottom to top is completely removed.
Gone.
Yes. And so with these, you lose a lot of the old growth structure, you lose a lot of those different age classes of trees. Everything is reset to ground zero. And so, you know, you can imagine how long it takes to for that kind of system to come back. So when you think about a prescribed fire moving through something, say, like a forest, you're talking about flame lengths that are roughly the height of a fire hydrant. What they're doing is they're moving along the forest floor, and they're slowly consuming all of the dead fuel that's there and not really impacting the canopy or anything like that. Prescribed fires are really good for removing that mid-story that blocks light from hitting the forest floor and removing that dead thatch, what we call thatch, dead grasses and leaves, removes that layer, and that means better seed germination. It means those seedlings are better able to compete. And so rather than this whole-scale destruction of an entire vegetation structure and system, you have something that is more so revitalized. It's given a chance for trees to regenerate and grow without that competition, and it's a chance to benefit the local native species that have adapted with fire over time.
Yeah, because as I understand it, if you're you have a better chance to get rid of undesirable plants if you do that.
Absolutely, yes. So the plants that are moving into these, especially the forest systems, but also out in our prairies, you know, these woody species, they change the vertical structure of our prairies. They push out birds that are grassland birds that are intolerant of that higher brush and tree structure. They can do a pretty detrimental job in changing the structures of these fire-dependent ecosystems. And for species that aren't used to occasional prescribed fire will keep them out of these systems if that fire is done at the right time using, you know, the right methods.
So how does it affect animals, or how does it benefit animals, a prescribed burn?
Sure. So I'm going to go way back to, you know, what we know about Wisconsin fire history. And so unlike in other states where you see lightning as one of the natural causes of a fire, you know, especially down in the Southeast, for us up here, our history of fire is primarily driven by Native communities that have lived here for
a long time.
Exactly. And one of the things that these cultures used is fire, not only to manage the land around them, but also to provide food for the entire group and also to lure certain game animals nearby because of those game animals' positive response to fire. And so, you know, whether it was a lightning strike or it was by human hand, you know, these animals, these systems, they have evolved with periodic fire. They know where to go. They have an innate sense of what is coming just when they smell smoke. And they know they either need to hunker down or they need to move or they need to fly. And what we've seen, both Jeb and I, as prescribed fire practitioners, is we've seen plenty of animals of all species return to a burned site, recently burned, and they are utilizing what is left there, whether it's woodpeckers eating dead insects that have, you know, fallen, or it's deer munching on the ash because it provides them basic nutrients and minerals. There isn't a time throughout that prescribed burning cycle where animals haven't gotten used to utilizing that piece of land.
Hmm. Jim, I want to go to you because I don't know that much about the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council. And here you are heading it up. Tell us more about the council's mission and what it does.
Well, we're a group of people who are interested in prescribed fire, as the name would imply, and that can range any anywhere from professionals who are practitioners of implementing prescribed fire, all the way through to private landowners who are interested in just being good stewards of their land and utilizing prescribed fire, learning more about prescribed fire so that they can use it on their own properties. And we're kind of everywhere in between.
Yeah.
But our bottom line is to get more fire on the ground safely and effectively.
So how do you help with prescribed fires?
Pretty much any way that we can figure out a way to get more fire on the ground safely and effectively. So we do training. We have we do outreach. We try to work with people to, if they're interested in prescribed fire, to figure out how to guide them towards resources to get that job done. And it can be through hiring a contractor. It could be through doing it on your own. It could be learning more about it so that you can do it safely on your own. But it also can be we're working with collaborators. And one of the reasons why Michelle and I wanted to come here together is that partnership is a really important part of trying to get more fire on the ground. There's
Absolutely.
Lots of different organizations that have a role in making that happen. And so as just one example, the council and the Department of Natural Resources are working together to create a certification program for fire leaders, what we call fire bosses, so that they can, that we have a more direct training to help people prepare on how to lead prescribed fires throughout most of the places in Wisconsin, from the pineries all the way through the prairies, basically P2P, so that they can do an effective job, you know, on a professional basis. That's at one end of the extreme, but we're also reaching out to private landowners who have a completely different set of needs to try and engage them to do prescribed fire on their lands. Because in the end, in Wisconsin, roughly 85% of land is still privately owned. And
yeah.
So if we need to get more fire on the ground safely and effectively, we need to work with private landowners to see, to figure out ways that that can happen.
And I imagine of that 85%, you know, the people who are landowners may have, may need some education, and I imagine there's always fear. I mean, well, right, for example, right now, today, you would not be doing a fire anywhere in the state because the DNR has prescribed the fire risk as too great. I think at least I got an email on that yesterday that said yesterday and the day were that way.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that I'm going to take this opportunity to expand on the high and the very high. You know, truth be told, when fire danger is high, what we mean that to say is that if fire is put on the ground, it stands a very big chance of spreading. The conditions are so that it is very favorable to spreading. And so, therefore, without the proper tools and equipment for suppression, water, you will not be able to stop that fire, and it will turn into a wildfire. So, you know, on very high days, we don't tend to burn. But on high days, you know, you will see people out there still prescribed burning. And that's because prescribed burning just isn't about going out, you know, licking your thumb, putting it in the air and, you know, and just starting. Prescribed fire takes some time to plan. You never want to go out there without a plan of, you know, what to do if things go wrong. But, yeah, if you're going out there and you don't have a lot of equipment, I would say pay attention very closely to high and very high. We do still have burns going when it's high, especially in the southeast right now, where we still have quite a bit of moisture in the marshes and the prairies. But, yeah, we have had to shut down burns lately because it has gotten a bit dry.
It's been dry in some parts of the state for sure.
Absolutely.
Don in Bayfield County has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Don.
Hey. I live when they do burns in Bayfield County at the Barrens, boy, the blueberries really take off.
Don, I'm so glad you brought that up. That is a blueberry crop was actually one of the main crops that a lot of these indigenous communities would harvest and maintain with fire. And, you know, just on a side note, the blueberries post-burn, they are much sweeter. And actually, any nectar from wildflowers out there, not that you have a chance to sample, but bees will actually prefer recently burned wildflowers because the pollen is sweeter. So everything's sweeter after a prescribed burn. I got to market it.
Don, thank you so much. I love that comment. What about you? You can join in too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. You can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Jeb Barzin, chair of the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council, one of our guests. The other, Michelle Wateka, who is the prescribed fire specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we talk prescribed burns with our guest today. By the way, Clara Neipert's our producer for this program, Trina LaSousa, our technical director, so I wanted to mention them as well. And our guest, Jeb Barzin of the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council, and Michelle Wateka, who is the prescribed fire specialist for the Wisconsin DNR. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, and you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Jean and Merrill next. Hi, Jean.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about bog geography. We live on a very small 150-acre lake in Lincoln County, and it really is perched right on the Ice Age Trail. So our own personal property, this is about property holders and their relationship to controlled burns, is goes from the lake shore to pine and balsa mix. And then very quickly, these tiny little bog areas. And I'm just wondering what.
Oh, we lost Jean. Maybe she got out of our area here. So she's probably wondering, and we'll turn to you, Jeb, for this. She's probably wondering about prescribed burns under those kind of circumstances. Could you do it in an area like that where you've got a small bog or a series of small bogs, but they kind of abut these pine trees and so forth?
Yes, it is possible to do. We're still learning a lot about prescribed fire and how communities, plant communities, animal communities are adapted to prescribed fire. And so understanding that bogs actually are fire-adapted communities is kind of a new thing because you think about it, it's, you know, bogs are typified by highly organic soils or organic matter that's been built up. And so the trick with burning in bogs is you want the water table high enough so that you don't burn deeply into that organic material, but shallow enough that the surface can burn, because many of the species, just like Don had talked about with blueberries, many of the species that are in the bog are stimulated by that fire, as long as that fire doesn't remove most of that vegetative mat. So the first part is, yes, some bogs are fire adapted, and they do benefit from being burned, and so it keeps them more of an open bog rather than a closed tamarack bog or black spruce bog. Sure. It kind of opens that up a bit. Mm-hmm. And but it also, I think this answer kind of gives people an idea of, oh, that's a little bit more complicated than I had thought.
Yeah.
And so you don't want to just go and say, oh, as Michelle was saying earlier, you don't want to lick your finger and hold it up for the wind and say, I think we'll burn the bog today.
Yeah.
It takes a little bit more effort to make sure that you get it right. Because if you get it wrong, it's real problematic. And the fire will go down deep into the bog. In the 1930s, there are some bogs that burned over winter because they could hold fire for a long time when the water table had dropped substantially. So something to be really important. But the other thing that Gene was talking about is that when you have pines that are next to it and your conditions of what is good weather for prescribed burning in pines and what is good weather for prescribed burning in bogs can be very different. And so there are times where you might want to separate them. There are other times where you could combine them together. But that's the interesting thing about prescribed fire. And I actually like the word prescribed as opposed to controlled.
Absolutely.
Because controlled just implies that you are controlling the fire that you're working with. But prescribed means that you're choosing your weather, you're choosing your place that you want to burn, you're choosing the crew who you're working with, you're choosing all sorts of scenarios to fit the particular needs to accomplish what you need to accomplish in that area. And so it's a much more complicated array of circumstances that you're really trying to develop in order to burn that safely as well as effectively part.
Sure.
That makes a lot of sense. And it does remind me that there, as you were talking, there's a lot of information out there, Michelle, for landowners and so forth, not only for a bog, but for any kind of prescribed fire.
Yeah, absolutely. So the council and the DNR work together to provide as many resources as we can for landowners who are interested in burning, whether that they want to burn it themselves and are looking at where to start, or if they're feeling like maybe for the first time or all the times they'd feel more comfortable with a professional. And so I'll leave it to Jeb as far as what the council can provide. But one more thing I did want to add, apparently because bog burning is so interesting, there's been recent studies that have come out that have actually shown not only the value of bogs in sequestering carbon, but also that these very, very rare burns that used to happen to them historically actually invigorates and increases their ability to sequester further carbon. So it is something to think about when we think about our carbon stores and who's doing the work and how we can potentially improve on that. But yes, of course, always the lower soil moistures are important, and we don't want to have a peat fire that pops up somewhere else.
Dave and Toma has a question. Dave, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good morning. I'm interested in seeing if there are groups that will come in and do a prescribed burn for people who don't have the resources or the know-how to do it themselves.
Jeb, go ahead.
There are groups that are out there. There are a number of different contractors located in, and they have areas that they focus on in the state. So there's very few contractors who will burn anywhere in the state.
Sure.
But lots of contractors who will burn in specific regions. And you can go to our website, which is prescribedfire.org. Should be an easy website to remember. And on that, we list contractors who are involved with prescribed burning. So that would be a first place where you can go to see different contractors. There are a few nonprofit organizations that sometimes will do prescribed fires on private lands, especially if they're adjacent to their own lands that the the organization might have. So you can also check that out.
I'm wondering if there are people here in the state who actually work on maybe even almost on a professional basis to fight fires, if they are also maybe part of these prescribed burn crews.
Yeah, you know, the best example of that is at the UW-Stevens Point. They have the kind of the longest running fire program, and it used to be primarily people who are getting trained in fire suppression, so that's putting out wildfires.
Yeah.
But now they're pretty equally distributed between those who are getting trained in fire suppression versus those who are getting trained in fire prescription, and there's lots of overlap between those two.
Of course. Yeah.
But there's really important differences in terms of how we approach training, and that's something that we're just really trying to develop now, and in part with a certification program, is trying to work on understanding how there's a really a different philosophy that is occurring with thinking about things from a suppression point of view versus thinking about things from a prescription point of view.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, 2/3 of our staff that work in the prescribed burn program are actually the same staff that are staffing at ranger stations and going out and suppressing wildfires. I can tell you that there's definitely different cultures. They tend to complement each other. But at times, yes, you see the difference in them. And I think the most important message that I can send is there are many different ways to walk into prescribed fire. You can come at it from a very organic place. You can come at it from a regimented suppression standpoint. But the fact of the matter is that we benefit from each other and we're getting the job done. But yeah, it is very interesting in the prescribed burn community. It's these different voices and perspectives are one of the things that make it great.
Mike and Mercer, we'll go to you. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Is the Wisconsin DNR allowing wildlife biologists to do prescribed burns? I think they used to.
Absolutely. It depends on the level of the workload in that area of the state. So not necessarily every wildlife biologist is involved. But if they're in an area where there's real high prescribed fire needs, especially on the properties that they work, then they're most likely involved in the program.
Interesting. All right, Mike, thank you so much for calling. Sue from Amory emailed us. She has a follow-up question about the blueberries responding with sweeter berries after a fire. She has a small patch close to her garage, so she doesn't feel she can safely burn, but would bringing in wood ash have the same effect?
I'm going to... Jeb, you want to take that one? I think that's so cool.
It will approximate some of the things that are done. There's lots of different ways that we can approach management. And often what we're doing is we're trying to get close to prescribed fire but not use it. So you could browse it, encourage if you had horses, for example, have horses come in and browse it. That would get some of the things that prescribed fire does, but not all. And the ashes, for example, are... recreate some of the things that you would have with prescribed fire, but not everything, because prescribed fire isn't just creating ash that then the plants take up the minerals that are in that ash. The prescribed fire stimulates bacteria that are in the soil, which become more productive, that then allow the minerals to be taken up, that the plants then produce more foliar growth and flowering, as Michelle was talking about, and that sweeter flavor. So it's really creating a whole system effect, whereas the ashes are just one part of that system.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
And so that's the cool thing about prescribed fire. There's really no replacement for prescribed fire writ large.
Sure.
But you can try to approximate it.
Yeah. There are other things like haying, mowing, brush cutting that can help change that vertical structure and reduce competition and get further, you know, sunlight onto the ground. But I mean, and we're not just saying this because we're biased, but
I'm biased. I don't know about you.
I remain silent. There are prescribed fire provides benefits that really no other technique mimics perfectly.
Yeah. So Sue and Amory, I don't know if you want to burn that right next to the garage, standing there with a fire with a hose looking. And I'm not sure at a really small patch. Would it really make a difference in a very small area?
Well, I think you can talk out of both. I'll talk out of both sides of my mouth
because
I'm kind of good at that. You can do that.
Uh-huh.
But this is fire prescription. So that means you have to choose your time, choose your day, choose your conditions, choose the what we call fire breaks that you have, the places where you can light fire from safely. So there's a lot to it, but it is possible. And one of the things that we need to do from the Prescribed Fire Council is figure out how to reach out with private landowners just in this sort of circumstance to say, you know, it's not as difficult to teach Sue and Amory how to burn her blueberry patch near her house as it is to teach a new professional prescribed burner who's going to try and burn any ecosystem in the southern part of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
You know, there's just really different difficulties that are in that. And so we're working at trying to do a better job reaching out to people like Sue or other private landowners who want to get some fire done on their grounds and figure out ways to enable them to accomplish that. And the variety that's involved in accomplishing that is as diverse as there are people out there who have the need. And so that's what we're trying to do.
So Sue might even get a hold of, go online to the prescribed, what's the address again?
Prescribedfire.org.
Prescribedfire.org.
Yes. There,
Sue, there you go. You might be able to do it yet. appreciate your call. Karen in Eau Claire, we'll go to you. Hi, Karen.
Hi. You know, when I was young, we used to live way up in northern Wisconsin in Nicolet National Forest. My dad used to do burns all the time.
Wow. Nice.
So I'm familiar with this, but now I live down in west Wisconsin in Eau Claire, and people don't burn like that around here. But I have a horse pasture, and I always wanted to burn it off to get, you know, better grass growing and get nutrients and stuff in there. Does that help for a horse pasture?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and not just because it would reinvigorate those grasses, but also there's studies that have come out of the Smoky Hills area of the in Kansas. Sorry, the Flint Hills, not the Smoky Hills, and they've actually looked at the effects of fire on grass protein content. And other things, you know, when you're looking into a cattle range. And they've actually found that not only with everything will everything come back, yes, taste is a factor and it will benefit, but also grass typically contains about 30% more protein after it's been recently burned. So, yeah, if this is a place that you have, you know, your horses utilize, this is definitely something that, I mean, if I was in your case, this would be something that I would be regularly doing every several years just to make sure that those grasses stay revitalized and they can keep growing.
There you go, Karen. You have heard it here first. You're going to have a better pasture.
There are two things that you want to keep in mind, Karen, and that is, one, it depends on how you're managing your pasture currently. If you graze it really tight, that means that there's not much vegetation that's available, so it's a lot harder to burn that area because you keep it grazed down so much. So you need to kind of reduce, at least in some of the areas, the amount of grazing to leave a little bit of dead vegetation so that that will burn. And the other, it depends on what's there. So if it's an old pasture that's was at one time agriculture or something like that, so it's typically going to have what we call grasses that grow when the soil temperature is cool. that often are exotic. You burn that at a different time of year than if you have a prairie remnant that's been grazed. And those grasses, you have to kind of burn at a slightly different time of year. So kind of what's there in terms of the species of grass, as well as how much vegetation you've removed, are both important things to determine how you're going to approach doing that.
And I think one more thing I would add is, you know, just like Jeb says, you are going to have to rest the field beforehand to make sure that you have enough vegetation that will carry the fire through the pasture. But also, you know, when you just have black there, you still have all the grass's root structure underground. But you may want to pause and let that area recover before you start introducing hoof action and further disturbance, because that might definitely introduce more invasives and break up the root structure that you do have. So it's just really about allowing that disturbance to happen and then giving that time to rest after the disturbance. But it's something that is very beneficial. And if you reached out later, we'd be happy to provide you some more resources on how to get it done.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for calling, Karen. Appreciate it. Kent in Reedstown called. He couldn't stay with us, but he's wondering if there's a bad time to bird during the year for insects. He wants to avoid burning the insects that make their home in the grass. And I know there are a couple times of the year when we normally burn. It's usually in the spring or in the fall. Jeb?
There's virtually no time that you can burn that won't be bad for some of the insects that are there. And that's both the good news and the bad news. There is a diverse array of insects that are using these areas, and so it's very difficult to not affect them. But the way insects often are adapted to fire is even though they might have a high mortality because of the fire, as long as there are places where the insects can recolonize from, they'll come back to that area and build their population numbers very quickly. As you know, we all know that insects are really capable of building their numbers rapidly. And the real trick is for insects that are what we call obligate to, say, prairies. You know, they only can occur in prairies. You don't want to burn all your eggs in one basket. So that you want to leave places within that prairie that don't burn when you're burning the other areas around it, so that you're guaranteeing that you have some of those insects that are not affected by the fire that can then recolonize the area that's where the vegetation is being stimulated by the fire and be more productive for those insects on a long-term basis.
And that unburned refugia is something that we actually plan for on sites where some of these insects are known to be, especially if they're listed. And that way they do have that unburned patch to colonize from and subsist there.
Trista sent us an interesting email. She's curious why there's not much objection to prescribed burning from people who are worried about air pollution.
Well, it's not to say that there isn't. We do occasionally get the comment about that, and it's totally understandable. Ever since last summer when air quality turned to everyone's attention. So the one thing that we do say in regards to air quality is, you know, when we do plan for a burn, we look at the neighborhoods, we look at the structures, the schools, airports, hospitals. Anything that if we sent smoke that way, we would negatively impact folks. And those are the areas that we choose not to burn in that direction. We try everything that we can in our plan to make sure our smoke is managed and goes off in a way that does not impact anyone. There's other factors that we take into account. We only burn on days where the smoke dispersal is going to lift and transport that wind away. And, you know, when we do have a burn and we do tend to have, you know, occasional smoke go across a road, we will contact local law enforcement to assist us with that. I mean, the point of this is to work and manage the land with prescribed fire with as little negative impact to the population as possible. But it is understandable with what happened in Canada last year. It was on everybody's minds.
Yeah, everywhere here in Wisconsin and a lot of other states as well. That fire burned a long, long time.
Yeah, and I want to go back to, you know, when we first started talking about the difference between wildfires and prescribed burns. You know, prescribed burns typically release about less than 1% of the emissions that wildfires like these will release. So the smoke is not as typically thick because whole, you know, trees aren't being burned up in the process. And so there is a difference between wildfire smoke and prescribed fire smoke. And prescribed fire smoke is something that we can do a lot of planning for.
And have you done some this year?
Absolutely.
Tell us what, give us a couple of examples.
Sure. So we have done a burn up at Crex Meadows so far, up in Burnett County. We have been doing quite a lot of burns along the lower Wisconsin Riverway, including 2,700 acre burn of Avoca Prairie, so right near the town of Avoca. We also have been doing a lot of really great work out in the Kettle Moraine State Forest over in the Waukesha area. And then, you know, there's so many properties around the state that people go to enjoy those beautiful vistas and those beautiful habitats. And we're working all through there. If folks are interested, they can have a look and see where we have been conducting burns so far this year. They can also see where burns are planned. And they can go back into past years with historic burns. And if I can either write out the website or if you Google Wisconsin Fire Dashboard, you will have our dashboards pulled up immediately. We've got one for wildfires and we've got one for prescribed burns. And that'll actually show you where we've conducted work so far. So we're at about 10,000 acres so far for the year. We did start a little early and we'll have to see whether or not the dryness shuts us down, but we hope to just keep trucking.
How many acres might you do in a year? What's the average number?
You know, in years past, in the last 10 years, we were probably averaging around 25,000 acres. But in the last 5 years, we've been able to do anywhere between 25 and 30,000 acres a year, and that's statewide.
Well, and that's just with the Department of Natural Resources.
Correct.
I think you're answering that question from. Yes. And the total amount of acreage is we're trying to be, we're up around, is it 75,000 acres?
Yes. So for what we know in terms of special permits in the DNR protection area, we know of federal burns, and we know of our burns. We're running roughly about 70,000 acres. But there's still a lot of spots in the state that we don't have information on, specifically in the cooperative areas of the state where the DNR does not have jurisdiction. Those burns are not tracked. So that is one of our endeavors moving forward, is to reach out to those practitioners and have them join with us in our you know, momentum moving forward.
Amphibians, are amphibians ever hurt in fires, or are they helped, or what, Jeb?
Fire can harm animals or plants when done improperly. And there's, you know, no, any time that you do any management practice, including doing nothing, you will have some species that increase, some species that decrease, and other species that are neutral. So kind of with that frame of reference, yes, fires can harm amphibians or reptiles, but we try to, because this is prescription, we try to do it in such a way that we minimize the damage and maximize the benefit is essentially, you know, what the goal is. And it's especially trying to focus on those species that are more adapted to that environment, especially when it's functioning on a healthy basis. So not all species can go in all places. And but, you know, if you have a ornate box turtle in the sand prairies in the lower Wisconsin River, we want to be able to burn before the ornate box turtles emerge from hibernation, because that reduces the chance of mortality to zero. So that's just one thing that we do in terms of how we go about doing a prescribed burn and minimizing the risk while still trying to maximize the benefit.
Well, that brings us to, you know, it's kind of a little segue into our next show, which is where we'll be talking about amphibians and reptiles a bit. But I want to thank you so much, Jeb and Michelle, for being with us today. It's been fun. I learned a lot, and I think our listeners did as well. Thank you.
So glad to hear. Always happy to talk about prescribed fire.
You're welcome, and thanks for having us.
Jeb Barzin chairs the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council, Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council. I want to say that right. And Michelle Wateka is the Prescribed Fire Specialist for the Wisconsin DNR. Great to have both of them with us. And we are going to be talking about amphibians, and we'll be taking a look at how pollution affects our amphibians, among other things, with our next guest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. You know, we have 18 species of amphibians in our state, and these creatures face, numerous chemicals that we introduce into their homes. And we're going to be talking about that, taking a look at how the pollutants impact amphibians. Larry Mueller here, my guest Jessica Waugh. She is an associate professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Jess leads the lab as well here on the campus. So as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about amphibians and how they're doing? Or maybe you're wondering how small-scale pollution is affecting the plants and animals around you. You can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Jess, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Thank you so much for having me. I can't believe I have the chance to talk about frogs.
Well, you are an interesting person. Your work, Crossroads Herpetology, Ecotoxicology and disease. Ecology. That's how did you come to that?
I would say I am still surprised that I am getting paid to do this work. I think when I first started, I didn't expect to be integrating all of these different themes into research. I started as an ecologist. And from there, it sort of transitioned to what might be changing the ecology in the world. And that's when we started getting interested in pollutants, common pollutants. And then from there, recognizing that the world is way more complex than just what a pollutant does to wildlife, but also how might multiple stressors interact to make a pollutant more or less toxic. So from there, we sort of transition to thinking about other stressors like diseases. And we know that two of the most important drivers of amphibian declines include human effects as well as diseases.
Yeah. So when we're thinking about herpetologies and so forth, what's the range of the – we have 18 species – here in the state, and that anything from a frog to
a toad,
toads, lizards,
salamanders. We've got reptiles, snakes, lizards, all around the state. We in my lab are really interested mostly in the amphibians, so the salamanders, the frogs, the toads, although two postdocs in my lab are working very hard to convince me to shift to more snake work.
Well, how did the amphibians catch your attention?
Actually, it was unexpected. When I was an undergrad in college, I played a lot of sports. So I went to school for basketball. And at the same time, I had a lot of pressure from my family to think about what I would do next. And coming from a refugee family, there were limited options. You could be a doctor, a lawyer, or maybe an engineer. So, you know, I went for the doctor route. And part of that was to learn about how you could get hands-on experience. And so I was away at a tournament when a teammate was like, you know, if you wanted to pursue medical school, you might think about doing a research experience. And I was lucky by the time I applied, which was very late. The only options left were to work with amphibians or to work with plants.
And you chose amphibians.
Yeah, and I'm a little slightly ashamed to say I chose amphibians because I thought they would be less boring because they move.
It is amazing how life turns out sometimes, isn't it? I love it. Well, so, and your amphibians are your favorite. But I'm wondering, what does studying amphibians tell us about the rest of an aquatic ecosystem?
Yeah, that's a great question. Amphibians are generally one of the most sensitive species within a pond. So they often serve as a sentinel species. So understanding what a pollutant does to amphibians might help us more broadly understand how a pollutant might influence the rest of the aquatic ecosystem.
So, and let's go back to ecotoxicology for a minute. What does the word mean? Go in a little more detail on that.
Yeah, ecotoxicology is an interdisciplinary field. It combines toxicology, traditional toxicology, with the added complexity of ecology. And so toxicology, the basic approach is to ask questions like, what does a chemical do to this organism? And this is really important because it helps us to understand which chemicals, which pollutants are toxic. However, as we sort of talked about earlier, it's way more complex than that. It's in nature, you rarely only encounter an organism with that pollutant. There are things in the environment, for example, a predator. And the simple smell of a predator in an environment can make a chemical more toxic to an organism. And so ecotoxicology is integrating in that ecology into our understanding of toxicology.
That is very cool. What about disease ecology?
Similar to ecotoxicology, disease ecology focuses on how interactions between hosts and their parasites can change. You can think about it as a triangle. So you have the host as one corner, you have the parasite as the other corner, and then you have as a third corner the environment. And so you can imagine the environment can directly affect the host by making the host more susceptible to its diseases, and they can also directly affect the parasite by making it harder or easier for the parasite to infect the host. And then that is sort of one framework for how we think about disease ecology.
You know, if we talk about environmental contamination, I think most of us will think about large events like an oil spill.
Yeah.
But your work really focuses on small scale contamination.
Right. We have sort of shifted gears in toxicology. One of the main objectives is to determine what is toxic. But what we are realizing is that concentrations or amounts that are lower than what is determined toxic can still have negative effects. For example, thinking about low concentrations of road salts, we have shown that low concentrations of road salts, like typical to what we might find in ponds, these concentrations, these levels don't cause direct mortality. But what they can do is they can make these organisms, these amphibians, more susceptible to other stressors like their diseases. So what we found is that those exposed to road salts are more susceptible to parasites like trematodes.
So road salt makes its way. It makes its way into a lot of discussions that are negative for sure, and this is just one of them. Yeah. You know, Mary Kay in Kenosha called, couldn't stay with us. She says, house lizards are native to Wisconsin, and they are very good to have on your property because they will eat pests.
That's right.
So they're not only fun to look at, or maybe some people get scared by some of them, but they serve a purpose for us.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's similar with amphibians, and this is something that is really important to me as a scientist. How do we communicate about why we should care about nature, why we should care about amphibians mm-hmm. and the environment? And, you know, this is important because coming from a refugee background, this wasn't something we talked about. Why would I work on amphibians as an undergraduate? I was lucky in that I fell into it and met passionate scientists who helped me to see the importance of an amphibian in the ecosystem. The number of mosquitoes and pests that amphibians eat contribute many, many services to humans. And so that's just one of many ways that one of many reasons why we might care about amphibians in the system.
Jessica Waugh, our guest today, it's great to have her with us for the first time, as a matter of fact. She is an associate professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR. Great to have you along today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mailer here, and we are talking about amphibians and pollution today. And we're lucky to have Jess Waugh with us. She's an associate professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. She leads the Waugh Lab here as well. And as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. Want to know how you can help Wisconsin amphibians, maybe. If you live near a pond or a stream or other aquatic environment, how have you noticed it change over time, perhaps? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jess, before we take a call, you mentioned road salt, and that's something your lab's worked on. What are some other small-scale contaminants or pollutants that your lab has researched?
Yeah, great question. We've worked on road salts quite a bit recently. In the past, my lab worked primarily with pesticides. So one of the interesting findings with pesticides, and it's not always all negative. We found that with pesticides, very low levels of common insecticides, if amphibians are exposed to these low levels early in life at the egg stage or at the hatchling stage, when they become tadpoles, they can actually be more tolerant to that insecticide.
Hmm.
So that's one way that these amphibians are adapted. And this is in specifically wood frogs that are adapted to dealing with pollutants in the environment.
And I think if we have, and I imagine you've studied the maybe interactive effect or effects.
That's right. Yeah. And I mentioned that these low levels might allow amphibians to become more tolerant later in life. But as we talked about earlier, it's never just pollutants in the environment. There are many other stressors like pathogens. And so while these low levels can cause these amphibians to be more tolerant, there's a cost. And that cost is that these amphibians that are more tolerant are also more susceptible to other diseases. And so it's a balance that we have to think about here.
Yeah. Camille in New Berlin, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm really happy to discuss this with you. I've had a lot of frogs and toads in my yard. I live next to a pond. And my Colorado spruce developed a fungus, that rhizoplasty kind of fungus, and mm-hmm. it was doing that needle cast. An arborist came and sprayed it for quite a few years. I didn't notice much change in the tree itself, but I noticed a considerable amount of decrease in the amounts of frogs, toads, no more snakes in the yard or anything like that. And I'm wondering, I looked it up, it said it's toxic to amphibians. I'm wondering how long that toxicity remains in the soil.
Yeah, thank you so much for the question. I think it's really interesting to have firsthand experience in sort of the effects of chemicals on amphibians. To answer your question, how long are the toxic effects of these chemicals? It depends on the type of chemical that was used in the tree, on the tree. We know that for many insecticides, they are developed to be very rapid decomposers. So the half-life, so how long this chemical is in the environment is relatively short. So oftentimes no more than a month. For other chemicals, it can vary. So I'm imagining that it's a fungicide, and many of these fungicides, I think, range from 2 days to months. And it really depends on the condition as well. So temperature, light can also influence their breakdown. One thing to keep in mind, it's not just the chemical that is applied that can be toxic. Oftentimes, the breakdown products of the chemicals can also be toxic. And if they're using a chemical that is a commercial chemical, there are often other compounds within the overall chemical that are often trade secrets that may have an effect. And so would you happen to know the specific chemical that was used?
Camille, do you know?
Yes, I do. It was myclobutane 20EW, 6 ounces per 100 gallon.
Okay. I am not familiar with that one, but one really useful resource that you can look into is each chemical has an MSDS sheet. So this provides information about how long that the chemical takes before it breaks down. So one recommendation might be to type in that chemical into Google and also type in MSDS and then look specifically for the half time, the breakdown rate.
Of that. Camille, did you get that?
Did I wrote it down? Thank you very much. Excellent program, as per usual.
Thanks, Camille. Appreciate your call. What about you? You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or if you want to email us, maybe an experience to share or a question, email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Sam in Madison next. Hi, Sam.
Hi. So I had a question about pollution and snow as it relates to snowpack and runoff. So I grew up next to a First Order tributary, and what I've noticed is that during the spring there's a lot of runoff, and that creates good habitat for amphibians, and I've noticed toads and whatnot going around or hopping around in there. So I was wondering, like, in terms of pesticides and pollutants, if we have more runoff, does that mean that they would be less affected? And does that mean that we would have more groundwater recharge in the area to facilitate these types of first-order tributaries?
Yeah, Sam, thank you so much for the question. I think there were multiple questions, and I'll try to answer those in pieces. I believe the first question was in regards to pollutants in runoff. Mm-hmm. And we know that a lot of runoff and pollutants, those interactions depend on the amount of precipitation. When it comes to road salts, we know that increased snowfall can lead to a higher pulse of salt into aquatic ecosystems. We know that also a decrease in precipitation, at least winter precipitation, can potentially lead to also a decrease in road salt use and the potential for road salts to enter into those systems. One thing to think about when it comes to recharge, amphibians tend to use ponds that range from ephemeral, so those that dry up over the season, all the way to permanent ponds. And you get different communities of amphibians in different types of ponds. So in the ephemeral ponds, the ones that dry up, you often get things that are adapted to these conditions. So those that can deal with shorter periods of water in the pond, that they can speed up their development to metamorphose faster to get out of these conditions. Toads tend to be able to develop very quickly. Within a month, they can go from egg to metamorphosis. In contrast, you have amphibians that live in more permanent ponds, and these are larger ponds. They can even use the retention ponds that you see around the city. One of the things that we are studying in the lab is how urbanization influences these amphibian populations. These would be green frogs and bullfrogs, which have much longer larval stages. In fact, they actually overwinter. So they will lay their eggs around June, July, and their tadpoles will take an entire year to metamorphose. And this is important because, as many of us experienced last summer, it was a major drought.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, as we're sampling these ponds around Madison, we're seeing fewer green frogs, likely because many of them did not make it to metamorphosis due to the drying conditions, and they don't have those adaptations to metamorphose or develop more quickly.
Mm. Sam, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And John in Two Rivers, we'll go to you. Hi, John.
Yeah, it's been 50 years ago or more. We bought a lot in the country and built a home on. It's a 5-acre yard that was originally a hayfield. And when we bought it, the farmer told us that we wouldn't see any snakes or reptiles of any kind because up until the 1950s, the field was sprayed with DDT. And he said that's in the soil and it'll probably be there forever. And it was true. We built a house. It would have been in the late 70s. And there were no frogs or toads or snakes or anything like that. Very few birds even. And gosh, it's been about 7 years ago. We had kind of a wet summer, and the yard was just covered with frogs.
That's
now,
amazing.
The toads came back first. The toads came back probably 10 years ago. And it may have been the frogs were earlier. I just didn't see them. But the toads aren't as clever at hiding. And when you get out in the yard, they're hopping all over the place. But the frogs were just everywhere. And my wife would tease me because when I mowed, I would dodge the frogs as I came up there. Last summer, they were kind of thin, but they're still there. We're on the river, a little river that flows into Lake Michigan. But it just amazed me how nature can come back if you give it a chance.
Yeah. Yeah, John, thank you so much for calling. Comment on that, Jess?
Yeah, John, I really appreciate the call because in part of the work that we do, we rely so much on community members to tell us these stories. We have a program called Friends of Amphibians where we have community members go out and listen and report observations about frogs and toads. And this information is so important because to understand how humans are influencing amphibian populations, we need a long-term data set that spans a broad spatial area. And so if you're interested in continuing to contribute to understanding amphibians, please check out Friends of Amphibians and also continue dodging with your lawnmower. We all appreciate it.
So how does he find Friends of Amphibians? How does anybody find it?
Yeah, Friends of Amphibians can be found on the Hua Lab webpage. So I am in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. From there, you can see our lab website, and there will be a link from the website to the actual website where you can get involved.
So if you typed in UW Forest and Wildlife Ecology, that's going to get you there eventually.
Yeah, look up Jessica Hua under faculty, and there will be a link to our lab webpage.
And Jess would like to have all kinds of friends, because it's a citizen science project, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It arose when some folks from the Friends of the Lakeshore Nature Preserve reached out and asked how can we get involved in amphibian conservation. And from there, we realized that Madison is in such a unique position to develop a community science program. There are so many green spaces scattered around the city, and many of these green spaces both have aquatic ecosystems, ponds and wetlands where amphibians breed.
Yeah.
And very, very dedicated community members who care very much about their green space. And so what developed from this is a collaboration between these friends groups across the city and my lab. So my lab, we develop protocols, training, everything is available online. And the friends group helps you coordinate some of these efforts. And one important thing is you do not have to be an expert to help us out. Many, many people just go out, listen, enter data into their phones. There's a buddy system that the different friends groups are setting up to help accountability, help us detect diseases of amphibians. There's a range. You can commit anywhere from 15 minutes per month to multiple hours per month. So the idea is to be as accessible as possible to as many people as we can.
And John, thanks again. I appreciate your call and your comments. You know, there's a guy who's got 50 years of observations. From his own farm, and with that kind of background of the DDT, it's interesting for sure. Grace in New Glarus, we'll go to you. Hi, Grace.
Hey, how you doing today? Jeff, I came at things a bit differently. I started catching frogs and snakes and lizards and stuff over 60 years ago.
Wow.
And we were living on a ranch at the time, and then the first time I saw a brand new foal, I was four, and I told my daddy I was going to be a veterinarian. And then I was, you know, learning more stuff. That I got a little squeamish about blood for a while, so I told my elementary school science teacher I was going to be a herpetologist.
Oh my goodness!
And she looked at me very strangely and said, "Herpetologists don't make any money." And I said, "I don't care." And then lo and behold, many years later, I was involved in some herpetology work up out of Pacific Northwest Research Lab and Humboldt State University, Redwood Sciences Lab, and then I wound up all the way in Florida doing research on gopher tortoises.
That's amazing.
And then I went to Southern California as the staff herpetologist for the Endangered Species Office there, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And then finally moved out here to work at the National the disease lab, the wildlife disease lab.
Yes.
So I have worked, assisted on
all over the place,
directly on projects with amphibians, both in terms of strict conservation as well as diseases and gopher tortoises. I did research on upper respiratory tract disease. Yeah, so hey, Jeff, you and I would have great fun together.
I welcome any interaction. We interact a lot with Dan Greer out at the National Wildlife Disease Lab, and it's been so amazing to be in a city with so many people that care.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Grace, thanks. You're going to have to go on to the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology site at UW and shoot an email off to Jess.
Yeah, I can't wait to meet you, Grace.
Mike and Slinger, we'll give you a chance. Mike, hi.
Hi. My question is toads. I have lots and lots of toads, and I have some leopard frogs and tree frogs and but the toads in the spring, I have a pond area about, but it's like 500 yards away from my house in the woods. And I can see little baby toads every year hopping across my driveway. It's all gravel. But I can't see how that they could hatch in that little pond and then come all the way up through the woods and then get to my driveway and then turn around and head back towards the pond. So I'm wondering, can they hatch in the woods under the leaves and the moisture? Do toads reproduce? Do they have to have water?
Yeah,
great question. The toads do need water, and I think what's really interesting about these toads, they produce strings and strings of eggs. There are thousands of eggs that are produced each year, and of those thousand, only a small proportion make it out of the pond. And then from there, only a small proportion then make it out into the woods. Then they'll spend much of their time in the woods until they get fairly large. Once they become adults, this can take anywhere from 3 to 4 years. And then that's when they return back to reproduce. And so maybe you've heard some of the trilling that goes on that usually lasts around May through mid-June. Those are the adult toads that have returned, and I would say they're about the size of a softball when they're returning back. But as I mentioned, very few of them actually make it back, but the thousands that they produce is one adaptation for the few that return.
Matt in Madison emailed us. He assumes that UW does amphibian counts. Wonders what your studies show in terms of long-term population fluctuations. Is there a website that summarizes it?
Yes, this is actually something that my lab has been working on. We are collaborating with the Wisconsin DNR. They have an incredible data set. There are citizen volunteers throughout the state that have been participating in frog and toad call surveys for the past 40 years. So we just received this data set about a few months ago, and we're working through analyzing how the populations have changed over time. A few things that have surprised us: wood frogs, surprisingly, are rare down south. We need more data on wood frogs. They seem to be fluctuating much more than other species. Toads and chorus frogs are abundant. Mink frogs are rare down south. They can be found up north a bit more. You have the cricket frogs, which are relatively rare. One of the things specific to Madison, we are surprised to find very few peepers as well as leopard frogs. And this may be due to urbanization. Those are two species in particular that we're curious about. But we'll continue to analyze this, look at how factors like temperature, drought, urbanization, roadways, proximity to roadways influence these amphibians over time. And again, this is a really rare data set because the Wisconsin DNR, they've had volunteers tracking this for 40 years.
Great citizen science for 40 years, yeah. 40 plus years. Man, oh man. Well, this has been really fun and interesting, Jess. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us. I hope you can come back. Do it again.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me and for all the excitement about amphibians. They're out right now. It's an
yes.
early warm spring.
Yes,
go out
are.
And listen.
Go out and listen. Jessica Hua, our guest today, associate professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Great to have her with us today, and we'll get her back, and we'll talk some more about what their research is finding, and we'll talk a whole lot more about amphibians with her. So we'll do that. Tomorrow on the show, it's time for spring cleaning. Chad Spate is back to tell you what your seasonal checklist should include as the weather warms around your home. That's tomorrow. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio.